Elaine and Sally regards to visitors at Nemata. I'm using my standard greeting. The word Elaine is Nahuatl, and it means the moment for a change of heart. And the word Sally actually means vibrant or undulant. So, for instance, the Northern Lights are Sally. In reference to the ancient mysteries, it was said that those who were initiated were transported to the vision of the Elysian Fields. And the Elysian Fields are Sally, because they are a zone or a dimension of radiant, vibrant, undulating light. That's the standard greeting I use. And I'm going to open this new set of talks on my channel with that greeting, in case you didn't know already what it means. So this is the first in a series of short previews of a talk in a unit, sometimes with text, that can be found on the visitors page of Nemata. And in every case, if you log in with an email and a username, you can access the units on the visitors page completely free. Purpose of this talk is to explain why the message of Gnosis is transgressive and why you are, in fact, forbidden to know it. So I'll begin with some simple points of language and grammar. Speech, both written and spoken, consists of two components: the words, the units of speech, and then the grammar, which is the system of constructing the words. Quite simply that. Now, it is a very great fact that I deliver the Living Gnosis today in the English language, and that is, as far as I can see, the best, the optimal language for introducing Gnosis in its present iteration, which is an upscaling and elaboration of the ancient Gnosis. And so, just like in any other field, you learn the terminology and you learn how to use the words appropriately. I define Gnosis in one way as applied noetics. So what I'm teaching is the terms and the organization of the terms or syntax of applied noetics. Now, of course, what I teach comes across primarily in language, both spoken and written, not to say that that is the only way I can teach, or not to say that that is the ultimate or best way to communicate. There are ways to communicate which are non-verbal and non-written, and they are tremendously important as well in the practice of applied noetics. But the fact is that we are living at the end of Kali Yuga, and one of the characteristics of the degeneration of this period is the corruption of language and terminology and misattribution, naming things wrongly. And because we are social animals who construct society and transact our social relations, for the most part, with language, also with body language, due to that fact, which is unavoidable, it's obvious that if language is corrupted, then all of our relationships will suffer, and they will likewise become unsustainable and, in certain respects, insane. And I don't think you have to be a genius to observe that the condition of the world order today, the social order, is far advanced into this terrible catastrophe of confusion. So in order to truly know something, You need to use language correctly. And what I teach always relies on that basic assumption, as well as on my primary purpose, which is to teach you to use your mind in the way it is designed to work, and not against the way or contradictory to how it is designed to work. And you can compare that goal, that aim, to what we all learn in school when we learn grammar. Now, I don't know if this is done anymore, but when I was in high school, we learned to diagram sentences. Now, in the unit for this talk, in the visitor section of Nemata, I provide an example of diagramming a sentence, and it may be new to you, and you might find it quite entertaining to see what that actually is. And very little is known of that today. For instance, you use the English language or any other language commonly without thinking about how the sentences you speak are constructed. Everyone does that. So if I were to ask you, what is a noun? You could say, you know. What is a pronoun? What is an adjective? You know. What is an adverb? You'd probably know those things, maybe not. But what if I ask you, what is a gerund? Or what is a copula? Or what is an infinitive? You see, you use those structures of grammar all the time when you write, read, and speak without having to go back and refer to what they are, because they are installed in your NLP. But in my approach to teaching applied noetics, I take you back to a state where you are actually reconstructing your NLP at an elementary level. And I do this through the precise definition of words and through exact syntax, phrasing, exact phrasing, which can be repeated. And when it is repeated and remembered, you are directing your NLP in an intentional way. You're not just parroting or repeating what I say. You're actually reprogramming your own NLP so that your mind works as it is designed to work. It's as simple as that. Now, in this talk, I'm going to concentrate on one word, one term, sacrilege. Don't hear it used very often. It was often used in the past in the reference of religious arguments and theological debates, some of which became bloody and murderous. And it is still the case today, vastly the case, that if you commit sacrilege, you can face very serious consequences, including death. So to get into it, let me tell you about the root of the word sacrilege. I often do this. I talk a lot about roots. And primarily, I talk about Sanskrit and Greek roots, roots that belong to the Indo-European language. And that is abbreviated PIE, Proto-Indo-European. So the PIE root of sacrilege is the word shak, which is generally spelled S-A-K, but the S is pronounced with an H. And shak is a phoneme close to shock, right? And shock, 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 right? It's a phoneme. And phonemes, by the way, are the sound units, the acoustical units that program your NLP. So shock means to have power or to exert power. And it is the basis of the word Shakti, which is the name from Hindu mysticism of the female or feminine divine power of the entire universe. So if you consider, and I invite you to consider, that reality as you know it is a materially real, three-dimensional film in which you are an actor and participant, not just a spectator. And this world display, which is called in Sanskrit Vishvarupa, this display of the world is driven by Shakti and supported by Shakti at every moment. So, for instance, suppose you're sitting at a table looking at a vase of flowers. Shakti is the operative materializing power that produces that vase of flowers, produces those flowers out of the body of nature, and at the same time, Shakti is what gives you the power to perceive those flowers, as well as the power to create the vase in which they are placed. So for the remainder of this talk, proceed to the visitor's page, scroll down to the panel that shows the units, and click on the title Sacrilege, and that brings you to a page with the remainder of this talk, as well as some written text and illustrations. So as I said in the preview, Shak, the Proto-Indo-European root, is the basis of the word Shakti, which is derived from it, which is also Sanskrit. But in the English language and others as well, it's the basis of quite a few words, such as what? What comes to mind? Sacred. Sacramental. Sacerdotal. Sacrosanct. Sacrifice. Sacrum or sacrum, which is a part of human anatomy, and sacroiliac, which is a definition for the mechanism of nerves and muscles and fascia in the human pelvis. Interesting that the word sacred is connected with the human pelvis, isn't it? And also, there's the word desacralization, an important word. What does it mean to desacralize something? Well, to the ancient Gnostics, who founded and led the mysteries, as well as to all the indigenous people of Europe, pre-Christian Europe, and post-Christian Europe, and indigenous native people all around the world, nature is sacred. What does that mean? It simply means that the animistic mindset, which is the default setting of the human animal, sees within nature the power that produces nature. Now, that initial perception is not a belief system. It is a real perception. The impact of the natural world upon the human animal carries within it the presence of that power. But it is one thing to sense the power in an animistic or superstitious way, and another to know and meet that power exactly in terms of what it is. So there are many words for that power. It's been called mana. It's been called wakantanka and orenda. And you could probably list 20 specific words that denote the driving and shaping power that is within the natural world. And so when human animals felt that power, when they received it, the natural response was to regard the natural world. The natural response to the natural world was to regard it as sacred. It has something divine in it, you see. But desacralization is the process of breaking that connection to the sacred, both the sacred in external nature as well as the sacred as it operates in the human psyche, which is another story. And as it does operate both externally and internally, to desacralize a people or a culture is to tear them out of that primary connection. And one of the ways that this has been done over many centuries is to program people with a belief that the earth is just a material body, rocks and dirt and some water and some clouds and plants, but actually it's totally material, and as material, it's dead, it's not alive. So to claim that the earth is non-living material, the earth on which you stand, is desacralization. That program has been going on for a really, really long time. Now, when we lost the mysteries, desacralization really kicked into high gear, because one of the primary topics in the instruction of the Gnostic initiates, the Teleste, was the presence of the sacred. So in the cover of my book, in its 2021 edition, if you get the right cover, because there was a mistake with it, you should see in the upper part of the cover a dark sky with stars and eyes in the sky. Those eyes in the sky on the cover represent the presence of the sacred, the livingness of the earth itself looking at you. And that image of the eyes in the sky is, of course, totally consistent with the message of the book. My purpose in that book was simply to bring the presence of the wisdom goddess to the world. Now, here on this point regarding the term material, you might suppose that I am speaking rather contradictorily, because I often make a point of the third principle of Mayavada Vedanta in the Gnostic revision: everything is material. But when I say that, the denotation of material is unique. When I use the word material in that sense, I mean living material, animated material. Everything is living material. And there is no material that is not conscious in some way, and no consciousness without material. So there is no such thing as any remote, abstract, or disembodied consciousness. This is a primary teaching of applied noetics. Now, speaking of the issue of denotation, this is problematical and at the same time highly instructive. So in applied noetics, there is a strong distinction made between what a word denotes and what a word connotes. And of course, that distinction is also made in grammar. However, it is not commonly made in common parlance. And so very often you will have a word, a term, a single word, comes to be known and widely used for its connotations, for what it connotes, rather than what it denotes. For example, take the word smashing. Well, that's a variation of the verb to smash, and to smash means to crush something, like smashing an egg with a hammer or smashing a rock with a hammer. But the connotation of the word smashing means thrilling, exciting, something that's done in an exceptional way, like a smashing performance. Take another term, badass. This is slang. And what is the exact denotation of badass? The literal meaning? Well, it would have to be an ass that is somehow bad. So it could be an ass like a donkey who is bad or behaves badly, or it could be a malformation of the human buttocks, You see, there could be several denotations, but nobody cares about them because everyone uses the connotations of badass. And the connotations of badass contain, as many connotations do, I should say often do, an inversion. So in fact, a badass is someone of whom you approve, someone who's good, someone whose behavior or performance or attitude impresses you and you like it. Something to be admired. A badass is to be admired, you say. So it's a good example because it's common slang in English, and it's clear that the connotations of badass are always used, and there's actually no reference to the denotation. When you hear that or say it, you don't try to think about what it literally means. And this is widespread in the use of words in English and other languages. So now let's look at the case with the word sacrilege. What is the denotation of sacrilege? And what is the connotation or various connotations of sacrilege? Well, you can look up denotations in the dictionary, and generally it's fairly reliable. So the dictionary definition of sacrilege is an act of violation or misuse of what is regarded as sacred. So one entry on the internet, an internet dictionary, gives an example. Wearing ecclesiastical vestments, as in the Catholic Church, for secular use or any other use than that prescribed officially by the Church is a sacrilege. So if you put on the outfit of a cardinal or a bishop and you went to a rave, that would be considered by some people to be sacrilege because you are wearing sacred garments for a purpose other than the one they are intended to serve, you say. So sacrilege, very strongly in its denotation, means violation or misuse of something that is sacred. Okay? So some people would say, if you took the Bible and you ripped out some pages and used it for toilet paper, that would be sacrilege. And the examples could go on into the hundreds. There are powerful instances of sacrilege in Christianity, and even more so in Islam, and also in a special case in Judaism. Y-U-D-A-I-S-M. So, by the standard denotation or definition, Gnostic teachings from the mysteries were regarded as sacrilege, the work of heretics, and they were accordingly considered to violate or oppose accepted doctrines of religion, and those who were promoting those religions, the Abrahamic religions, all agreed that the Gnostic teachings ought to be condemned and forbidden. So one connotation of sacrilege is it is something to be forbidden. But there's another way to translate the word sacrilege, which is composed of the root sac, and the Latin, I think it's the Latin verb legere, meaning to read or write. So another definition, which is genuine, would be the reading or writing of what is sacred, the reading or writing of sacred knowledge. That's actually the core definition of what it means. But you see, that definition has been spun and turned around to mean the act of violation of the sacred rather than the act of teaching the sacred. And what the Gnostics did, and what I do today, is teach the sacred. And in doing so, I commit sacrilege. And in fact, even though my works can be accessed, talks and texts, not in his image, it's all out there. No one's going to come after you if you attempt to buy the book in a bookstore or order it online. Nevertheless, it is sacrilege, and you are really forbidden to access the living gnosis today. It is transgressive. It is something that is under a taboo. Now, how is this taboo enforced? Well, I don't want to go into a long song and dance on that, but I could speculate. For instance, how come my channel only has 5,000 subs? Not that the subs listed on a YouTube channel is anything to rely on. I'm just using it as a prop to make a point. How come it doesn't have 50,000 or 150,000? And how come when I did, for instance, the 64 talks on the Mandela effect and I decoded it in Gnostic terms with hundreds of references to the wisdom goddess Sophia and the Sophianic narrative, how come, to my knowledge, almost no one of the other millions of people who were following the Mandela effect during that year, 2017, 2018, came to my channel? I never had one comment in the 8 months that I ran Mandela Effect Decoded of someone saying, oh, I just came from this other channel where they're talking about the Mandela Effect, and that's how I found you. How come no one, to my knowledge, found me in that way? That is evidence that the work that I put out is under a taboo, and you are forbidden to access it. But at the same time, there's a trick involved. Were those who consider my work sacrilege to make too big a show, too big a display of repressing it and declaring how evil it is, they would bring attention to it. So you see, I'm guessing that whatever procedures are taken to shadow ban me or prevent the spread of what I teach, it's done more or less on a stealth mode. It would not benefit those who would like to forbid you to know the way of Gnosis. It would not be to their advantage to bring too much attention to me in the process of condemning me for sacrilege. Can you see that? Now, in concluding this talk, I'd like to make a distinction between material that is considered to be taboo and classified material. It's not the same. For instance, go to the long-standing Hindu tradition of Brahmanism, which is kind of like the Hindu counterpart to Judaism. It is a cult based on genealogy. So the Brahmin caste is a special caste, a special genealogical lineage set aside from the other people in India, traditionally set aside. And the Brahmin traditionally wears a white string around his body over the shoulder and down by the waist to indicate that he belongs to a sacred lineage, which is a notion totally identical to that of Judaism. And it's extremely hierarchical, this system of Brahmanism, and it's male-dominated. And there are levels of declassification. So if you were to come as a young Brahmin man and study with an elder Brahmin, you would be introduced to the Brahminical teachings on a scale, on a ladder. And There are certain things that you would not be told at first. They are, in effect, classified until you reach the level where the guru or master deems he can inform you of those teachings, you see. So there are many instances of classified material in the world religions. And, for instance, in Judaism, in the Talmudic doctrines of the so-called spiritual teachers of that program, there are certain things that are completely taboo to discuss outwardly. And there are two types of taboo in this case. One taboo is certain things must never be said. You are forbidden to reveal certain things to those who are not racially identified as Yehudim. But then, even within the race, even within the limits of that definition, there are certain things in the Talmudic teachings that are only revealed at the higher stages of education. And you find that routine procedure, those protocols, vastly evident in the pseudo-spiritual systems of the Kabbalah and the Zohar. So, Kabbalistic teaching, the tree of life, the working of the paths of the Sephira, all of that is hierarchical. If you were to study that with someone who was a master of Kabbalah, they would not tell you certain things about how the system works because they are classified. And you have to reach a certain stage of knowledge and prove it, and then that material will be classified, will be declassified for you specifically based on you proving what you know, you see? But this process of classification is not identical with sacrilege. In fact, in the Living Gnosis today, in the way that I've organized it and the way I deliver it, there is no strict classification. Obviously, you do better with a more advanced type of teaching if you don't hear it in the first place. But very often, I've brought out the most advanced teachings to the newcomer, and I frequently do this. So even though, of course, there are basics you have to learn, and then intermediary study, intermediary practice, and so forth, the system is totally open source. There is no evidence of levels of classified and declassified in the Living Gnosis today. But on the other hand, that body of teaching, which is unique to Nemata, is classified as taboo. The totality of it is taboo and transgressive, you see? And so, in conclusion, I'll tell you in three simple beats, how come? How come it is taboo? Bear in mind that I am quite certain about something regarding the teaching that I put out, verbal or written. I am quite confident that some of those who come to it just regard it as more blah, 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 and yeah, 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 and cha, cha, cha. You know, so what's the big deal? Oh, there are all these systems, the old systems, the traditional religious systems, the teachings of Theosophy, Anthroposophy, Gurdjieff, on and on and on. I wrote a whole book about it called The Seeker's Handbook. And there are dozens and dozens of schools of yoga and yogic philosophy. There are dozens of schools of New Age spirituality. It's like a buffet that might be laid out in a football stadium. So there you are walking around in a football stadium among all these tables that are setting out different offerings to eat, and there's Nemata. And so what is the difference? What's the big deal? Well, in one respect, I admit There is no difference. It is just another table laid out with things to eat, food to sample, dishes, and desserts. Just another table on the turf of the football stadium. But there is something that distinguishes it hugely from all the other food on offer. You cannot name another system of any ancient or existing religion or any so-called spiritual and metaphysical program, such as the teachings of Gurdjieff or the teachings of Aurobindo or some American spiritual teacher, I can't think of their names right now, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, who taught about Saint Germain, or Rudolf Steiner. You know, all of these, which run into the hundreds, belong to one category. They are free of taboo. Nobody is telling you that you can't investigate and practice those systems. And it might appear that nobody is telling you that you can't investigate and practice the living gnosis today either, but that is in fact the case. And whether or not the offering on this table where I stand can be distinguished from all the other blah, 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 it is distinguished in that way. It is the sole system that is under a heavy taboo, and you are in fact forbidden to know it. There are three principal factors behind this condemnation, behind this accusation of sacrilege, which applies to my work. Sacrilege and anathema. I did a talk on why I am anathema. Sacrilege and anathema are practically synonymous terms. I said I'd tell you in three beats, what is it in this body of knowledge and practice that you are forbidden to know? One, the story of the wisdom goddess, the fallen goddess scenario, which is the biography of the living earth that explains the origin of humanity, the design of human intelligence, the presence of the archons, and many other things that are not explained coherently in any other system. Two, the origin of the archons, which, as I say, is a subplot of the narrative, but the Gnostic intel goes deeply into that origin, and it explains and profiles the archons and how they operate. It explains their powers. It explains how they work to infiltrate and subvert the human mind and corrupt the human animal. And it also explains the measures that can be taken to ward off the archons. Three is the most transgressive and taboo subject of all. And it's due to my handling of this subject, my open treatment of it, that I don't get invited to many platforms. For instance, I have not, since Not in His Image came out 15 years, I have not been invited to talk on a platform with others, scholars and commentators who are discussing Gnosticism. That happens due to the fact that I disclose and elaborate the Gnostic warning. Now, the Gnostic warning, which I cite in my book and elsewhere, is not something I invented, and it is not something that you can call John's interpretation. In fact, the Gnostic warning that I present is a citation in exact language from a passage in a book of a heresy hunter named Irenaeus. The book Against Heresies contains explicitly the Gnostic warning, and that is taboo, that is sacrilege. and no one wants to go there. And I have never seen, so far, in all of my years of collecting and studying books by Gnostic scholars, of which I think I have about, 60, 70, I have never seen any one scholar ever refer to that passage in Irenaeus. You are not supposed to know about that passage. And so, there it is. The totality of those three factors, plus an enormous range of instruction regarding the correct use of your intelligence, how to interact with the wisdom goddess, how to recognize and defeat the archons. All of that is what you find in Nemeta. And so Nemeta is the consummate example and the epitome of sacrilege. Enough said.